Welcome to Just JKing, the podcast where we transform your HR headaches into high fives. Whether you're a founder, CEO, or just someone with HR questions you're too afraid to ask, we've got the insights, laughs, and light bulb moments that you crave.
Enjoying the show? Hit that five-star review and subscribe now so you never miss out.
Welcome back to Just JKing.
Today, our very special guest is Rick Makos, a dynamic and results-driven executive with a proven track record of accelerating revenue growth, transforming organizations, and leading high-performance teams.
Beyond the boardroom, Rick's leadership foundation was shaped on the football field as an OUAA champion, all-star team member, and CFL draftee. Serving as team captain at the University of Toronto instilled in him the values of discipline, teamwork, and resilience, principles he applies in building and mentoring top-performing business teams today.
A lifelong learner and forward-thinking leader, Rick holds a Bachelor of Science in Geology and Physics with a minor in Computer Science from the University of Toronto.
And in addition to his role as Chief Customer Officer at Inflection Point, Rick serves on multiple boards, mentors emerging leaders, and advises on industry trends that drive innovation in customer-centric business strategies.
Welcome to our podcast, Rick.
Happy to be here. Really excited and looking forward to having a chat with you guys.
Well, we're excited to have you, Rick. And so we need to start by asking the obvious question. You were a team captain and a CFL draftee. How did you take that experience as professional athletes, and how does that influence your leadership style in the corporate world?
You know, it's good timing since we just watched the Super Bowl, right? And if you look at any, so the 53 people that were on the field, all of them very different roles, different assignments, different skill sets, even if you're playing side by side on the offensive line like I did. So there's a whole lot of trust. There's a whole lot of teamwork that has to happen. So really, I actually built a real respect for, I trust these guys with my life. I trust these folks with my success. And I trust that they're going to execute their assignment 100%. And, so that's the primary thing to help build, the transfers almost one-to-one to the corporate world. And then I think it's this practice and preparation, right? Is that we were constantly figuring out, okay, what's our game plan to success? Just like, hey, here's my success for, where I am now in my business plan. Here's the play I'm going to run in a particular account or a particular meeting. So that preparation and practice, I think, just instilled the discipline for success. One of my, I apologize in advance. I tell a lot of stories. So one of my favorite football players is a guy named Jack Lambert, happens to be with the Pittsburgh Steelers. His line was, hey, I play for free. They pay me to practice. And that's a great line, because that's the grind of getting better, and there's championship teams practicing today to win the Super Bowl, even though it just finished. So those are the main things that I think transfer quite well to the business world.
It's also really interesting, though, because when you actually think about professional athletes, I think it's only like 10% of the time that they're actually playing the game, whereas it's that, 90% preparation, both physical and psychological. How does that translate to the business world?
Yeah, I think you get used to, I always say I've learned how to win, but I also learned how to lose too. And what I mean by that is, okay, I make mistakes, the team made mistakes. In football, they go through literally frame by frame by frame. I mean, it's not so much in the digital world, but they can say, show Rick Makos on third and one, in the red zone. What did he do? And you get a frame by frame look at what you've done. So all the ego, all the, bravado goes away when you start saying, okay, I did step wrong. I did, I can improve that 1% to get better. So I think that's just that knowing how to lose and turning a loss into a learning opportunity that makes you better, right? I mean, I think that's the one thing that I learned a lot of is that all the ego goes away and, you're just, because the first thing I think coaching women is very different than coaching men. Like if you actually give women feedback, they honestly take it to heart, right? Most men will go, yeah, I didn't do that. I was perfect, right? So they have to see it on film and then they go, yeah, I messed up. So, it really just blows away your ego and you really focus on improvement.
The film comes in handy. I love that. So Rick, personally, in my professional life and my personal life, I've observed that mostly women, as a frame of reference, that participated in team sports growing up actually really seem to excel at life and find some things easier than people who did not, like myself. And I always try to encourage any parents that I'm friends with to put their kids in team sports for a reason. I think it teaches them to lose. I think that's an excellent point. But for those of us who didn't have parents who cared to put us in team sports, what are some shortcuts you can give as a leader to help individuals achieve those same results once they get into the work world?
Yeah, to me, it's always been pretty simple. If I wanted to help a salesperson get better, I got in the car with them and went to sales calls, right? I helped them prepare. We do joint meeting plans, and we'd have a little coffee before, a tea before, and say, "This is what we're going to do, and here's what I want you to do, Rick. I don't want you to take the bat at my hands. You're president. This is how I want you to help me." And then we'd do a review afterwards, right? And say, "Okay, Rick, you could improve. Jennifer, this is what you could do better, but you did these things great. Let's build on that, right?" So I've always just found that it's kind of simple. Lead from the front, get out there with the team. Now it takes sometimes takes a lot of time. COVID threw a little bit of a wrench in all that, but COVID, I think, helped me build what I call, I've done some presentations on this, digital emotional intelligence. Is you had to have a whole different set of cues. Oh, Kim Tabak just sent me an email at 1 o'clock in the morning. First reaction is, "Oh, we want more Kims. She's fantastic." When you really should be saying, "Well, why is she working at 1 in the morning?
Right.
There's something going on in their life." I had to go get training for my team and myself to say, you need to look at different cues during COVID so you could actually start to build a different set of emotional intelligence in the digital world. So again, to me, it's those one-to-one interactions, leading at the front, getting involved. And I can't make it much more complicated than that. I mean, a lot of people can't, you can't do that from behind a desk.
My favorite one is, and we've already confessed that I'm from the Maritimes, so I'll give you a nautical analogy, but it's that whole like a high tide rises all boats mentality. So they're obviously fiercely competitive, but they also work as a team, inside their organization, if you will. And I think that's a big thing that people are missing. They're really reluctant to become sort of co-reliant on their coworkers so that high tide will rise all boats, not just the one that you're sitting in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that you just got to teach it. It actually, it's a little bit of bravery and trust that you got to build with those people, right? That, you got to relinquish a little bit of control to a teammate that has a different set of skills that's going to make you more successful. So, yeah, I 100% agree with you, Jennifer. Really good knowledge.
I want to double click on that, Rick, actually, because that's something that we see a lot with small and medium-sized businesses that are going through massive growth, is that the leaders, the CEO and the leadership team often have a hard time relinquishing that control to the team. And I think that that is one of the themes that I see over and over again with organizations that are having a challenge really scaling. Talk to us a little bit about that, because it's something that I say all the time, which is basically like I used to say this to my team. If I have to do your job, then who's going to do my job? But when you've always done the job of everybody else, when do you know, or how do you know as a leader, when is it the right time to really let other people take over? Because that is like the key to success.
You gave me a little advice is that you tend to become wallpaper, right? The leader just drives everything, right? So you got to really do some self-reflection and go, wait a minute, I'm not that person, right? I'm a person that really, drives and gets in front of customers. So, the techniques that I've used is empowerment and empowerment in two ways. Not only do I give you the responsibility to control your day. I said, you know what? I don't care how much vacation you take, as long as you do your job. We've got all these balls on a teeter-totter is what I describe them, from business results, customers, your own goals. And you have to, do that balance. If one falls off, we'll have a chat, right? So I try to move empowerment and money as close to the customer as I can, so that they have expense money, they have money so they can make decisions. You want to go to a trade show, go. I mean, just make sure you communicate with everybody where you are, what you're doing, what the end result and outcomes are. So that's always been my love to give the advice to our governments, right? Maybe we should just move all the money to the municipalities, right? Get as close to the customer as possible. So that's been my technique. And then I've never, I'd say out of all the times I've done that, I could count on my hand where people misused that or made the wrong decision. Or if they made the wrong decision, it's a coaching moment. It's a moment to have some discussions with them. So those are my techniques. And the ones that are uncomfortable with that, rise to the top, and it's a different set of coaching to help them, take advantage of that empowerment.
Just to go back to something that you said, which I don't know that anyone would have the context of, which is the analogy of the wallpaper. And I think it was a conversation you and I had once about why is it that someone is brought into an organization? It's because of their unique skill set. And what we often do is blend in after a while. And it's really difficult to remain your true self when you're working within a larger team, and there's definitely a team dynamic. That's also a sports-related lesson. Can you give us some insights on how to effectively do that as a unique leader with a unique background coming into an organization of people who might have worked together for a really long time?
Yeah, maybe I can tell a quick story, and I don't know if I've ever told the story, so I apologize again for the stories. It is a football story. So my mother was an Italian immigrant, my dad was Polish, so I could joke and say I'm a po-op. You could take that out if you want, but since I'm a mix, I can do that. But she came to every game. I don't think she ever watched a play because, you're in this violent game where there's a lot of hitting, and certainly when I was a lineman, it's all about hitting and pushing people around. So when I was in high school, I played on every line. Lots of announcements saying Rick Mako scored this touchdown, Richard Mako scored that, to that tackle. So my second year at university, I was second team all-star, doing quite well, but I was an offensive lineman. The only time she heard my number is when I got a penalty,
Ha
64 holding, So again, there's that ego that has to go away because you just got to blank that out. So she came up to me after a game. She goes, "Oh, they called me Ricky. So you're welcome. You're friends now. You can call me Ricky." She goes, "Ricky, I apologize. You're not doing very well. I really feel sorry for you because all I hear is when you're doing something bad." And I said, "Well, maybe I should explain what I do." And I kind of explain what an offensive lineman does. They block for running backs. They protect the quarterback. They, run downfield and push people out of the way so everybody can get more yardage or whatever, right? So this, uneducated Italian immigrant goes, "Oh, so your job is to make more people more successful." And I went, "Yes, I am." Right. So I've leveraged that kind of message from my mom in my head all the time. If I come into a team, I try to figure out how to make each person successful, take them to the next level. Perhaps I block for them. Perhaps I do something else for them. I remove a barrier or I help them through a situation. So that's what I've always used to try to ingrain myself into the team as someone that needs to fit in, is try to help them get a little better, even in a small way, even a 1% way. And then all of a sudden, people want to actively associate with you and you're moving forward.
All right, Rick. So you've led massive revenue growth at multiple companies, including Inflection Point and Teradata. What are the fundamental strategies you use to turn around struggling businesses and scale them successfully? I'm sure you have some gold for our listeners there.
Yeah, you know what? I always start with customers first, right? When I took over Teradata, we were a Teradata Canadian organization that was, less than 2 million. Customers were about to light stuff on fire. They were about to move stuff in the parking lot, light these servers on fire, get them out of here. What I did is I just erred on trying to understand what they wanted to do. What were their issues? Why was Teradata not responding correctly? And I always would tell my friends, "Well, you're a president. What do you do?" And I had two jobs at that time. I was president of Teradata Canada. I was also president of NCR Canada, which owned Teradata. So I said, "Well, 50 to 60% of my time is customers first. Another 56% of my time is people because I got to make everybody successful. And another 50% is the numbers, right? Making it all work and make it, well, that doesn't add up to 100. Well, that's the job, right? These are high bandwidth jobs where your customers and your people are number one. The financials are two, but I've always just really, really focused on generating value for customers, and the business came. I had a couple banks in on my relationship over 15 years that I can add up almost $800 to $900 million of business from trying to strike a match to light this thing on fire. So it's generating value, understanding their needs, and making sure that you actually de-risk these transactions so they feel comfortable buying from you. Those are kind of the three big things that I've focused on.
I really like your answer to that question, Rick, because I think it sounds a little bit to me like sometimes people overthink this stuff and you kind of just go back to the foundation of what works.
Happy customers and sales kind of solve all kinds of problems, right? I mean, if you don't have the, they're the raw material to for change, right? If I don't have the revenue, I don't have happy customers, I've got no raw material to pay for a different change within the company, right? It allows you to get more people, allows you to get to, perhaps transform a piece of your business. And I mean, sales is not a four-letter word. A lot of people think it is, right? Regardless of my title, I'm a salesperson. I'm out there, trying to convince a customer to do something valuable together.
Yeah, I love that because salespeople really get slagged a lot on LinkedIn and stuff. And it's like, oh, I'm sorry, you have one of those magical jobs where nobody has to sell something in order to make money. It drives me insane.
Yeah,
Like
my magic wand is
everybody,
broken. It doesn't work anymore, so I have to go talk to
yeah, exactly.
every company sells. I don't know why you take a personal offense to it. Like, just kind of tells me that actually your business acumen is quite low and you're bragging about it on LinkedIn.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the good salespeople, I've been lucky enough to be involved with, I don't know if you know the Challenger sale. It's a, I think, a new way of selling. Since 2002, I was involved with the customer executive board. A guy named Matt Dixon and his partner wrote a book called The Challenger Sale. But what to write the book, they collected data by going on sales calls with salespeople. And there were about five or six salespeople. I've met Matt a number of times. He probably doesn't remember me now because he's rich and famous, published author. But I mean, that actually really ingrained me to what came out of that methodology, because it was all about teaching the customer, tailoring your message, and then creatively taking control of the sale. And we would do that on a regular basis at Teradata. We had to understand their business, because it was IBM or Oracle we were competing with, right? We weren't the incumbent. We had to sell value. We had to really get the customer and show them, through the minefield of what the decision they're making. I've had some really great salespeople, that took that teach, tailor, and take control to the next level, where I would just sit back and watch, well, Leslie's in control. Like she's controlling this meeting, but customer feels like it's a partnership, right? So
And I think that that's key. I think that there's really two things that make that a successful approach. And one of them is the ability to build a deep relationship and to demonstrate that you understand the customer. And the second part is it's data driven. It's about doing your homework and your research. Can you tell
absolutely.
us a little bit about where you think data plays an important role in the sales process and in business in general, Rick? Because I know you're very much someone who believes in data-driven decisions.
Yeah, from a, let's just say preparing to take a customer to the next level, you have to do the research. You have to go and understand their business. You can't go in and expect them to teach you their language. You've got to understand their language before you get there, right? And people say, well, that's hard. I'm proficient in financial services, retail, manufacturing, telecommunications. Thought I was proficient in public sector. It's changing lately, but so you can learn. You've got to put in those hard hours. Get an annual report. Get annual reports for the next few years. Go research into industry reports. I used to pay a person out of my pocket to go, and this is before ChatGPT, and I'm dating myself, before the internet was a really prolific thing. They'd go and pull together news feeds for me, put it into a central document, so I could see all the things going on in retail, financial, telco every week. And I just devour the stuff up, right? And that was part of it. So I really understood and could speak their language. So I think that's one thing. And then it's the lens of what's specifically going on in their business. Looking at a balance sheet inside an annual report and really understand, well, why that expense line's high, why, right? What does that translate to in their business? What are they trying to change? And that just takes work. And then conversations with the customers. So you start playing catch on their terms, right? And then you'll find, those golden nuggets, Jennifer, that say, okay, this is what the pain is. And I think the real trick is, the really cool part of the challenger is that you build up this credibility with the customer, and you really understand their business. And then you have to generate some emotional impact. And some of that's creating a bit of a negative impact, meaning, hey, well, Loblaws is a customer, and Hudson's Bay, you're not doing this, and they're really successful. I suggest you do a derivative of do this. So you try to say, well, wait a minute, my competitor's doing this. So you're kind of striking the match on the platform, like you're lighting the fire, the burning platform, to get them to act. And I think a lot of salespeople do that in an abrasive way rather than a consultative way. And that's what, I think my teams have been really good at, is that they've been, and that's research, that's data, that's hard yards, and then those hard relationships. I think then when it comes to just data in general, I think people just, they have a hard time for some reason, even Inflection Point and others, they have a hard time pulling together a view of what's actually happening in the business, from the customer journey all the way through to booking the revenue. So you could start to see, well, wait a minute, I have all this recurring revenue. It's not being recognized correctly. I'm not, I could pass time to the people that are in my professional services team to fix tickets, and I could get my way through a couple of, peaks and valleys. So I just think pulling that 360 view of your business together, by the way, in my view, it's not hard. It's just something you got to get done. And then starting to look how those things can actually, analytics can really impact the business. On the sales side, for example, I find that, for example, one of the things we found by applying analytics into the pipeline is is you could actually see, wait a minute, I've got my best salespeople on the worst opportunities that are unqualified. So you could start to see that in the data. Or believe it or not, this is another book from Matt Dixon. I'll give him credit again. It's called The Jolt Effect. Over 60% of the deals in a pipeline are just non-decision deals. Customers are not deciding. Your biggest competitor is doing nothing. So you have to go figure out how to. So really de-risking the transaction is really what you got to go figure out. Instead of lighting the match, I now got to work with the customer, say, well, this is about you're removing your fear of messing up by selecting me. So I got to de-risk that transaction, right? So, we've even put clauses together called, repair, replace, refund clauses that, customers go, oh, so you'll repair it, you'll replace it, and you'll refund my money. And you could actually see the tension of the shoulders. Absolutely. I mean, we're here to make you successful, right? So understanding what sales situation you're in, is it one where I gotta promote action or I gotta run this play that de-risks the transaction for the customer because they just don't want to move off the status quo because they want to keep their job, right?
Another area I really wanted to touch on, because I know that it's an area of expertise for you, is M&A. Talk to us a little bit about some of the biggest challenges that leaders are facing during the M&A transactions, and how do you navigate them successfully?
There's a couple things. I think the merger, you guys will appreciate that the mergers of the cultures is the primary challenge typically. I'm always surprised how little HR is at the table at some of these companies for the M&A
100%.
transactions. In fact,
It is interesting though, right? Is that most organizations are acquiring businesses which are filled with people, and yet nobody's doing due diligence at the front end on the people, which is
craziness, right?
fascinating to
Yeah.
me. Yes.
And that can break you, like,
For
totally.
sure.
Like my
Totally
first
break
day on the
you.
job, first week on the job at Callisto, we're in a leadership meeting and I'm like, well, where's HR? Like we're doing planning. Where's my HR person? Well, she doesn't come to these meetings. Like, well, she's going to now.
My
And
goodness.
I remember when I called her, I said, why don't you come? We're at an offsite meeting. I said, do you mind coming? Because I want you to participate. She was saying, you scared the crap out of me because I thought you were firing me. I go, no. I mean, you're my partner. I mean, it's a people business. I mean, we get our revenue out of the billable time of people. I need you as a partner, right? So that's the first thing I think is making sure that HR is a partner in the transaction and involved in the transaction, not after the fact. You should be assessing culture and, for example, I wasn't told this when I took over this one company, but they had almost 20 people leave because they're overworked and they weren't addressing that part of the culture. So, I mean, there's something I had to deal with right away. And, we had resource management challenges. And by the way, I just spoke to customers and said they were keeping it from them. I said, well, we've lost 12 people. Probably another eight are going to go. We need to figure out how to resource your project.
Yeah,
So,
compensation challenges, benefits
yeah.
challenges,
So, number one is culture, right?
for sure.
Figuring that out. And believe it or not, I think then it's systems, right? I mean, there seems to be this tribal knowledge that say, wait, I wrote this system. So it has to be the system that is our CRM, or it has to be the GL. And meanwhile, you might be buying a company that basically says, you know what? They got a better way to do this stuff. So, really understanding either do it one of two ways. Accenture, when they bought Callisto, they just had a template. We're going to SAP, boom, 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 boom. Like everything was laid out, right? And is it best of breed? You can argue yes, no, like who cares, right? They had a process. All that was done within weeks of the transaction. So I think you either do it that way and just say, hey, this is how we're going to go. We'll improve down the road. We'll buy best of breed for timekeeping or something else. But this is how we're going to get you into our system. So that's the second thing I think people, because you end up sometimes saying, well, I built this and it's crap. So, here you go. Rather than saying, let's do something different and new, right? So systems are a lot. And by the way, HR has got to be involved that too, right? I mean, it's a big part of it. Then I think it's, I hate to say this, I mean, I sound like a broken record, is the work with customers. Who are the joint customers? How, making sure they're clear on the transaction that's going on, that there's no, because they're, even though they say they're fine, they're not. We need to go and explain the transaction, how it's going to affect them, how it's going to be good, what are some of the challenges. And then what are like customers that you can potentially start to duplicate in your own, in the merged business, right? So, for example, I have this pharma, it's adjacent in this marketplace. Let's go after this one. How did you win, right? So that, I think customer mapping for su customer success and customer mapping for growth seems to be an afterthought a lot of times. I don't know why, right? I mean, they just figure out, I've stuck it together. We've married revenue together, all good, right? When there's an exponential opportunity there, right? And again, that takes get in cars, go see people, talk.
And so, with that being said, Rick, the new generation of talent coming into the market today is a lot less accustomed to doing that face-to-face conversation, right? A lot more email, a lot more text messages, leveraging AI. How is technology changing the game right now in a sales environment?
Yeah, I think it's a positive thing, right? It's another tool in your ability to get to a customer. So I have multiple channels now. I perhaps can, I use a LinkedIn automation tool where I send messages and emails, well thought out while I'm sleeping, right? To build pipeline, right? So I think there's some great tools out there. There's intent tools that you can actually start to see buying intent, well in advance of them. There's this, call it no person's land where they've decided they're going to make a change and they're going to start evaluating, and no salespeople are in yet until they actually do a request to the marketplace. That's your chance to get there first, right? And I think all these tools give you a chance to do that. I think it does take a focus on what is the message. I think we've talked about this in some of the sales training I've done. So you've got this really cool thing. It's called a phone. Like you can actually call and talk to somebody. You hit a button, you can talk to them in person. Really neat piece of technology. You can send them a message. But think about what that message is. If I'm going to leave a voicemail, it should be written down to say, when I reach Jennifer's voicemail, this is what I'm going to say. So it's a little branding message. So all of that's work and preparation. And I think that's a common factor. You just got to get people to do the hard work to prep. You now have a couple extra channels with AI that can do work for you. So think about the message and how you want to get out there. So I think it's a great thing. We're even looking at like an automated AI BDR, right? Which even has an avatar and much nicer to look at than my face. So it'd be pretty cool. So I think these are things that are an advantage. I think they have to be deployed correctly so customers don't think they're being ignored and I'm talking to an AI agent. So we got multiple channels, just like a bank has multiple channels to reach their customers. So this omni-channel approach is has to be well thought out and planned. If you just spray and don't think about it, well, you'll probably alienate more customers and get new ones.
So I want to ask about digital transformation now because I live in the capital of this is how we've always done it. And I understand you have lots of experience with your work at Inflection Point on, adding controls and automation. I'm dying for our listeners to hear how you start companies on that digital transformation journey. Where do you usually find you get asked to come in? Like, what's the starting point? Because here, like I said, we're starting from, but this is how we've always done it. So I think if I have any island listeners, they'd be very interested to hear about what your approach is to digital transformation.
Yeah, you know what? It can be first off, you got to figure out who the right people are, right? There's going to be operations people in manufacturing. There's going to be people responsible for supply chain. Believe it or not, a lot of people that are in charge of greening the organization. Like for example, I've got some sustainability goals. I had this one lady at a very large chemical company that was a great customer, and she changed her job was in this, in charge of all the sustainability programs. And I remember calling her going, I'm pretty sure you're not in charge of blue boxes. And this has some money. She goes, yeah, this is going to be the foundation for our transformation is optimizing, our power infrastructure, all that kind of stuff. Right. So your entry point may be very different. I think you just got to figure it out. Right. I mean, so I think it's a good understanding of that company using those relationships. And just because someone's in charge of a sustainability program doesn't mean they're charge of they could be driving the digital transformation. So I start in many different areas. I think the one nice area to start if you can't find something is analytics, right? So helping them with their data, getting a consistent view of the data, their manufacturing operations, what they're making, and then just start to look for ways you can optimize the gross margin that comes out of that. It could be improving the mix of a bunch of stuff that's going in to make bread. It could be the front end process of how it gets cut and put into bags. How do I reduce waste on that? For example, a lot of people don't realize this. If a piece of bread or a loaf of bread is 750 grams, if it's 800 grams, that's giveaway. I've just given away 50 cents, 50 grams of profit, right? If it's underweight, I forget what the standards are in Canada, you got to throw it out. You can't put that bread in
Right.
there. So that's all
Right.
waste, right? That's a perfect analytical problem where you can start to, zone in on that kind of Goldilocks zone of doing that, whether it's bread or juice or oil or something else, right? The return on analytics is about 14 to 15 to 1 for every dollar. So you can get in to say, here, you know, I was able to do a quick learning about how your business works, provide some value. What if I were to look at that holistically for your whole company, right? So that's a technique I use a lot. I've done that. So a small analytics project has grown into a little acorn, grew in a nice big oak tree for me, right? So for the team. So that's a quick start. And it also identifies right away that they have all these islands of information, even on the factory line, that they're not learning from. You get a chance to pull all that together into one cohesive set of data that they could start to use to analyze it. And again, that gets them down a path where they can start making some better data-driven decisions. So a $50,000 project could result in millions, right?
For sure. So can we talk a little bit about your education, Rick?
Sure.
I mean, I love it. So I don't know that I've met many people who have studied geology and physics and became CEOs. And you and I have actually had conversations. You legitimately love geology. Like, it wasn't just one of those throwaway, yeah, you know, I took it because it was something that I was fascinated in then. You actually worked in the field. Tell us how you translated some of those experiences into your current career.
I think one of the things I did is I think I was flown up by a helicopter to go map out a diamond bearing mineral, you know, where they just threw me out of the helicopter at 15 feet, me and my buddies, right? So you're looking for some bit of gold or a diamond in all this raw material, right? So I think in many cases, we were collecting data to do all that, right? So,
right.
I mean, that was a big learning from the get-go. The other thing about, I think, geology and just call it earth sciences in general is the best models for success are organic models, right? I mean, if you think about it, the way that Mother Earth works and stuff like this, you know, if I want to learn about a customer, it's not a single-minded thing or a single transaction. It's this organic evolving thing that I collect information on and learn. And those are the models that I think just work best. And, you know, applying those in business has been good. The other thing I approached is once I got a sales, you know, I started in sales, right? Somebody said, I graduated when all the government cuts, they took all the R&D for anybody that was exploring for minerals and oil in Canada, used to get a dollar for dollar. So if I spent $10 million, Canadian government would get 10 million. So they cut all that the year I graduated. So yeah. I had to be adaptable, right? So I think I went from potentially 100 job opportunities to 2, right? When I was looking around. So I moved into sales, and the best advice I got from a guy named Ron Thompson, great guy, you know, he said, try to look for opportunities to learn that, you know, for example, I took a role from sales into finance that I knew nothing about finance, but it came up, the person trusted me. I was so afraid. I didn't even know how to use a spreadsheet. I was taking courses on the fly to so not only did I became really proficient in spreadsheets, understood finance and how the numbers were behind the business. I got involved in some transactions to acquire companies. I ended up making more money. Like, it was such a great experience. So it taught me, hey, move laterally and even maybe take a pay cut to get something that will help you. What did you want? You know, I wanted to be a CEO. So finance was pretty important. So I took a pay cut to go learn finance. You know, I took a transfer role into services to understand how professional services were. I took a role in product, right? To understand what's the, like, product marketing and marketing are two different things, right? A very, you know, very, very precise way to release a product, train salespeople. So I took these lateral moves to build up the base that I thought I needed to be a CEO in the high tech world. So Ron always said, hey, just devour these opportunities like it's your first day on the job and you'll be fine. And it was really good advice. So my MBA is from the street, right? It's out there taking jobs and sometimes pay cuts to learn.
That's the way to do it.
I love that. I love the courage too. It does take courage, but I think it's very smart. It's a long-term play. I like that. All right. So looking ahead, Rick, what qualities do you believe will define the most successful business leaders of the next decade? And what advice would you give to aspiring executives, which I think you just already gave them some, but is there anything else you want to add to that?
Yeah. You know what? At the end of the day, we represent the collective results of all our people, all our team. And it's an honor to do that, right? It's a privilege. So don't disrespect that privilege. I think that I see too many big egos. Oh, I'm a CEO now. You know, I'm a senior executive now. I mean, I had one customer take me down. I think when I got my first VP role, I'm a big note taker. I happened to show up in this meeting. I didn't take any notes. I remember the customer told people to leave. I want to talk to Rick. And he swore at me, go, hey, you're not taking notes. You're too good for me now. Like, what? You get a VP and I'm nobody? Like, don't ever forget who got you here, right? So, I mean, I think that's the thing, is that you just have to forget the ego. It's not about power, it's about empowerment. And your job is to create an environment for them to be more successful and more employable. And then you, shame on you if you don't have an environment of business that can keep them employed. That's on you as a leader.
As my favorite Peloton instructor says, no ego, amigo.
Exactly.
Oh, I think it's remarkable the number of times that you've said the word people since we started this sales slash data analytics conversation, which I think is really, really telling. And I think other CEOs should probably take note of that.
So, Rick, we do have a number of questions that we ask all of our guests. So we'll start with one question and then we're going to go into rapid fire. Jennifer, do you want to take the lead here?
All right. So, Rick, what's the one thing you believe small and mid-sized businesses can do today to change the game for their people? There's that word again.
Go talk to some customers, get some orders.
Yeah.
Right?
Great.
For sure. Okay. So now on to the rapid fire, Rick. I know you will not disappoint. Ready?
How's my hair? Is it all right? Okay.
Your hair's amazing. Amazing. It doesn't look like you wore a helmet for 20 years at all. So, first job.
My first job, paying job.
And your first job.
Yeah, I was a laborer for the Ministry of Natural Resources, fixing houses and putting up little Stelco sheds for some homes that they owned in Cochrane, Ontario. So I was a
Amazing.
laborer. Yeah.
Wow.
And your best job.
Oh, gosh. You know what? I really enjoy what I do right now. I mean, because I get to help a lot of people, right? I mean, it's a chance where I can not only help the company I'm working with right now, Inflection Point, but I mentor students. I'm old, right? So I'm, near the end, closer to the end than the beginning. I have some flexibility, right? So I can help students. I'm doing at the University of Toronto. So I like the job I have now because I get to help a lot of people.
Your biggest mess up at work.
Oh gosh. Yeah, it's a sales story. I was the account executive on Royal Bank. I was ahead by like 40 million, but everybody else, I was my own little small country, huge ego. And I was trying to get this one upgrade for these servers that were in branches, and I got beat by IBM. And now they were doing maintenance on my server. It was horrible. Like, it was the worst scenario. So when I actually, and one of the people I had to deal with is my current wife. She was actually, one of my teammates back at NCR when this happened. And she says, "You need to go talk to all the people because people hate you right now because they don't want to deal with you because you're an asshole. So you need to go and talk to all them, and because it's the reason you failed was because of you, not because of them." It was a real change for me. I mean, I think I fell in love that day with her, as well as fact that I had to really, really change the type of person I was. If I didn't change then, I believe it, I would not be who I am today. I went and apologized. I went and got a bunch of data, and then we recovered from that. But it was the worst beat because it was just me being egotistical and not listening. And yeah, it was bad. Good lesson. I'm happy I turned it into a learning, but it was awful.
And also, you turned it into a very successful marriage. So there you
I probably shouldn't tell the story, but I'm not sure if I can swear on this channel. But she wanted the meeting started with she brought me into her office, and she goes, "By the way, sit down, shut up, and F off," right? She told me that. And I'm kind of going, "Yeah, I think I'm in love."
Okay. So the next question, Rick, which you kind of answered, but I'll give you an opportunity if that wasn't the best. What was the best learning?
Yeah, that was it. Yeah. Pivotal moment where you change the person you are from, being a driver and uncaring to someone that actually really did care about people, right? So that was my moment.
And the final question, what is your quickest quit?
I'm assuming that's when I'm working on something and I've just decided it's got no future and I'm leaving. Yeah, I guess it's been, quickest has been about a year for me. I've had some consulting engagements that didn't, where I went, "Okay, this ain't working," after a couple of weeks, and go, "I can't take your money anymore because you're not listening, so let's part ways." So that's been a few weeks sometimes, but that was more of a consulting gig than it was a full-time job. So I'd say a year for a full-time job, which by the way, I think careers just work differently now. I mean, that timeline is different for a lot of people. But yeah, I've had consulting gigs where I just went, "Yeah, Mr. CEO, you're not listening. You seem to be the problem. And guess what? You should not give me your money." So that's been a few weeks.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay, so Rick, I know that you're working full time right now with Inflection Point out in New Jersey, but you do a bunch of fractional work as well as a CEO. How can people get in touch with you?
Find me on LinkedIn, Rick Makos. If you go into contact information, it'll have two different emails. It has my cell number, so they can do that. You can reach me if on the podcast, rick.makos@markcable.com. I'm at your service if anything comes up. But that's another line I use a lot, is I'm at the service of my customers and my teammates.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today and for all the amazing stories. We love storytellers.
Well, it was a real honor. You know, I've got the utmost respect for Kim and her capabilities, and Jennifer, I've now grown a love for what you've done as well. And I appreciate that you've allowed me to participate in this podcast. It's been great.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Just JKing. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and took away some valuable insights to shake up your own HR game.
If you loved this episode, and we hope you did, make sure to hit that subscribe button, leave us a review, and share it with your network. We want to hear your thoughts, your feedback, and even your own wild HR stories.
And don't forget to connect with us on LinkedIn or drop us a message. Let us know what topics you want us to dive into next.
Until next time, keep it real, keep it human, and always keep JKing.
We'll see you next time on Just JKing. Thanks for listening.